Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at theelmstreetgroup@morganstanley.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. By now, it's a well-known fact that New Hampshire college students graduate with more debt than their counterparts elsewhere in the country, with an average of $36,000 to pay off. That's according to the nonpartisan Project on Student Debt. Meanwhile, the college loan landscape itself is changing. Long dominated by regulations from Washington, the new Federal Education Secretary, Betsy DeVos, says the system is way too complicated and must be streamlined. It's a goal many support, but some with strong reservations about how DeVos wants to go about it. Today in The Exchange, student loans, the policy debates, and practical information. Join us, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from D.C. is Adam Harris, breaking news reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Adam, it's great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
Also with us in studio, Tori Berube, Vice President for College Planning and Community Engagement at the NEEF Network. That's the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation. And Tori, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Nice to see you, Laura.
Also with us, Kevin Petrowski, President of the New Hampshire Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. Kevin is also Assistant Vice President of Financial Aid at Southern New Hampshire University. And Kevin, good to have you. Thank you also for being here.
Thank you as well.
Well, Tori, I'll start with you. So why do New Hampshire students keep getting that dubious honor of having the highest debt levels in the country? Also, not surprisingly, our students are more likely to have loans, 76% of our students versus 68% nationally. So how come, Tori?
Well, great question. And I know you've done a lot of work on this previously, so probably no surprise to your listeners that we're in a state that our public institutions, community colleges, and the university system of New Hampshire typically have higher costs of attendance than our counterparts across the country. We are seeing students who take both federal student loan debt and private student loan debt on to manage that cost of college. So we're in a position where, as a state, we do not have a state grant program to assist the most neediest of needy students directly. So lots of reasons. And typically here in the Northeast, cost of colleges, cost of attendance is higher than anywhere in the country.
Oh, that's interesting. So we don't, some states, even though they may have equally high costs, have a state grant program that helps out students
Correct.
In those states.
Correct.
What's your thought, Kevin?
Well, definitely to touch upon the state grant program. I mean, the reality is there's two states in the nation that don't have a need-based grant that promotes access, and New Hampshire is one of them. And then, obviously, the cost of education in New Hampshire, it does rise. And why does it rise? There's a lot of decisions. In the public sectors, there's a lot of political awareness in that in relation to enrollments and growth. And there's a lot of deferred maintenance across the state of New Hampshire at the institutions because they're older individual institutions. So the reality is sometimes in order to have that space and with enrollment growth, they need to expand. And what does that do? That impacts the tuition dollars.
Interesting. So, Adam, what's the difference between high debt states like New Hampshire and low debt states elsewhere?
Well, it's, you know, you really kind of, if you're, you know, comparing the two, you know, if you're looking at your high debt states, they're going to need more federal assistance. Whereas if you're looking at your low debt states, they typically tend to, you'll see schools turn down some of that federal assistance.
Go ahead, Adam. Give us a little bit more on that, because I was looking at the map and the high debt states seem to be in the Northeast and the Midwest, the lower debt states out West. So what do those Western states have that we don't?
They have, you know, kind of more state-supported
Actually, that's a very good question, and I can I'll actually have to get you an answer on that one if you can come back to me on that one.
All right. Well, and when you're on Capitol Hill covering it, you know, you can ask some of the policymakers up there. Go ahead, Tori. Did you want to jump in?
And to his point, for instance, out west, California does have an amazing state grant program. Arizona has a grant program that is able to help these students afford and access higher ed at the state level.
So, Tori, what do you hear from students and their families about just jumping into this, about, you know, taking on some pretty big loans at a young age?
Daunting. Sometimes it's a surprise to parents that their students are about to turn 18 and head off to college. And for many millennial parents, Gen X parents, millennials, they're starting to realize that when they graduated from college, they had a couple of thousands of dollars worth of debt. And now that they're seeing what that possible debt load looks like for their students, eye-opening, sometimes working with families, younger families that are trying to figure out how to pay for college, how to manage retirement, right? Their own personal retirement. So having conversations about how do we do this smartly in the state of New Hampshire, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we help your student follow their dream, pick the college of their dreams, but do it in an economical way that works for both your student and for you?
Yeah, I love what you said about smartly. And Kevin, give us a little bit more on that. So what do you think people need to keep in mind as they approach this whole confusing picture of student loans and doing it smartly, as Tori said?
Well, one of the major things is obviously to do your research for choice of college. I mean, there's a lot of consumer tools out there that promote transparency. And that started in 2010 and onward, where the federal government required institutions to disclose a lot of information that I don't believe parents and students are aware of nowadays. But there are a lot of consumer tools like the College Navigator, the College Scorecard. These are tools that help with comparisons to realize what the true value of that education is and to disclose the actual net price of the institution. And what net price is, just for our listeners in definition, it really is the cost of education at the school minus any grants or scholarships. So that's the free, it's what we call the gift aid. It's the free money, because in the end, all the other funds that need to be covered are made up of something that's most likely borrowed.
So the smart way to do it is to do your research.
Do your research. That's the first step.
Well, and Tori, I can see you want to jump in. Quick follow-up for you, though, Kevin. From what I understand, you can't really assess how much help you're going to get until you're accepted, until you filled out all the forms and so forth. So sometimes it's hard to figure that out up front, isn't it?
Actually, there's a great tool. Yeah, I jumped right in, Kevin. Sorry.
That's okay.
One of the tools that he mentioned College Scorecard and College Toolkit, which are federal tools. But one of the tools that the Obama administration implemented, which is an incredibly helpful tool on every college that receives federal student aid has to have, is something called a net price calculator on their website. And a net price calculator allows families to go out, even as young as your you mentioned you have a high school junior, and if that high school junior has a dream of where they'd like to go to school, and you'd like to see what a typical financial aid package might look like from that school, usually on the financial aid page of every college's website will be a net price calculator, a how much does it cost me to go to school here calculator. And the idea is that you're putting in some information about yourself, your student, and when you do that and click submit, up comes what a possible financial aid package would look like from that school. So that gives you a tool or a ballpark ahead of even applying for financial aid or applying to that college of what an actual financial aid package might look like.
So it's gotten a lot more transparent.
Absolutely.
And easier to do that research that you talked about, Kevin. Yeah.
Yes. And I just want to promote for the net price calculator is based off of, I won't go into the acronyms, but it's based off of data for first-time, full-time students. So the reality is our split across the U.S. and in New Hampshire is 50% traditional, that's your 18-year-old going to college, mm-hmm. versus the non-traditional student, which is adults returning to school. So just realize that net price calculator tool, very efficient and great tool, but it really does drive the traditional population versus assisting the transparency of the cost for the adult, the non-traditional population.
That's interesting. And I just saw a headline this morning, Kevin, that said, you know, the college student body has changed, as you're alluding to, and our financial aid systems need to change with that. So it sounds like we haven't really caught up yet.
That is correct.
All right. Again, the number for you to join us here in the Exchange with your questions and comments as we look at student loans, the politics, and the practical information. With New Hampshire students' high debt and loan levels, we're finding out what changes may be coming, what's on the table for students and their families right now. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Adam Harris, breaking news reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, also Tori Berube, vice president for college planning and community engagement at the NEEF Network, and Kevin Petrowski, president of the New Hampshire Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Adam, going to some of the policy that is behind some of the very practical pieces of information that we've been getting from Tori and Kevin, people talk, Adam, about the student loan industry. What is the student loan industry, Adam, and who's in it?
Well, the student loan industry, essentially, the Department of Education, you know, issues billions of dollars in student loans each year. And after those loans are issued, they're serviced by, you know, several different agencies. So you have Navient, GreatNet, Pennsylvania Higher Education Assistance Agency, several other loan servicers. One of the interesting things that's happening right now is that the department is moving to a single loan servicer as opposed to the multiple loan servicers that we currently have.
Yeah, so remind us about these loan servicers, Adam, because they've been in the news a lot lately and some of those headlines have not been very flattering.
Yeah, so we've seen some loan servicers get a lot of bad press, especially Navient, who's had a lot of issues with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But what this change will do, essentially on May 19th, Secretary DeVos issued the next set of rules and the department's upcoming procurement, which is essentially a competition for choosing a new company to service the billions of dollars of student loans that the department issues. Now, this would be a switch from the Obama-era policy that essentially had, you know, the student loan servicers create a single portal by which people could pay off their student loan debt, but it did not have a single student loan servicer.
Okay, so the idea is to consolidate it, make it easier. And that's a goal probably a lot of people support, Adam, right?
Well, it's been a mixed bag because having a single loan servicer and it would seem that that would make it easier, and that's the department's argument that they can have better oversight of a single loan servicer. But the argument is that it would create a too big to fail situation, essentially.
Too big to fail. That's the line that we heard after the financial crisis. So some people are concerned that consolidating these loan services would create a similar situation. That's the debate that we're going to hear set up, Adam.
Yes. So,
yeah. Okay. Go ahead, Kevin.
I just want to note that actually we had one servicer from 2003 to 2013, and then the servicers had expanded, and there were many, many lawsuits that were brought up based off of customer service, wait time, and in order to when they explored the option with repayment plans with the servicer to actually get into the correct one that fitted the best needs of the student.
So having one servicer, repayment. You would say?
I'm just saying it's been tried before, and then it branched out again, and now it looks like we're just trying to look back to that. Now, again, we don't know about the federal standards that are associated with this new plan for the one servicer, but the reality is this has been tried before.
And had some concerning
Yes, it has some concernings and some monetary issues.
Let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Wayne joins us from Durham. Hi, Wayne. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. This is Wayne Burton. I'm really, really antsy about this discussion. The level of debt in student debt in New Hampshire rates directly to the appropriation to the university system, the lowest in the country by far. And it's having a worse effect in that almost 60% of New Hampshire high school graduates go out of state and they stay there because of the level of indebtedness they have to incur at the university system, their public school. If they go to the public schools, they stay in New Hampshire. House Bill 603 made it all the way to the floor of the House. It would halve the amount of debt a student would have to take on at a public higher education institution in New Hampshire. There is nothing, zero, in the current state budget or legislative process that does anything to relieve student indebtedness in New Hampshire and also encourage them to stay here And that's why we have the highest out-migration of young people in the country. This is a huge issue.
So this is Representative Burton. Is that correct, State Rep?
That is correct.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. And so some frustration there, Tori, on the lack of state support for our public education institutions here.
There is. And this year, you know, you've seen earlier this summer or earlier this spring, UNH announced a program called the Granite Guarantee in hopes of keeping some students here in the state that are Pell eligible by, in theory, covering the cost of tuition at UNH if they are Pell Grant eligible, meaning they receive federal aid, free money from the federal government for college. If they are Pell eligible at UNH, tuition is waived for all 4 years that they are at UNH. Great initiative, but that was driven by the school and not by our policymakers. In the work that we do at the Center for College Planning at NEEF, we do see students come in with financial aid award letters in the spring of their senior year from in-state and out-of-state public and private schools. And families are making very tough decisions about perhaps it's not mom or dad's alma mater of Keene, Plymouth, UNH, and their students are going to other out-of-state state schools or private schools because it is more cost-effective for them to do so.
So even though the sticker price might be the same, the amount of aid that these students are going to get outside New Hampshire is that much greater.
Correct.
Do you want to jump in on that, Kevin?
Honestly, that is a reality. The state funding for the public system has been low, historically low, in secondary and post-secondary education. And also, yeah, it drives people out of there. I think New Hampshire institutions, along with the New Hampshire state, need to start looking at workforce partnerships in order to collaborate with what employees' needs and wants are within the state in order to keep the graduates remaining in the state, and to be able to assess their student loan debt.
To Representative Burton's point, and I am not sure that this is the accurate statistic, but the most current statistic, in that it's been historically said that if New Hampshire increased its funding for its public university system, we currently rank 50th, and if we doubled what we contribute as a state, we would still be 50th.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in real quickly with our June fund drive. So, Adam, I want to go back to you when you were talking earlier about the loan servicers and possible changes in federal loan policy. Just stepping back a second, Adam, why is it that so much of student loan rules and regulations seem to be managed by the federal government? How come?
Well, essentially, the thought is that you can have better oversight when the federal government is overseeing the federal loan portfolio. So if you have everyone reporting to one agency their amount of loans that they're trying to issue each year, each school reporting to the federal government, it makes it easier. Now, access to that data is becoming more abundant, but it's still kind of problematic. The dearth of data that we have.
The dearth of data around what, Adam? Go ahead.
So that could be the student loans, what kind of students are getting loans. And essentially, the biggest issue is the outcome data. There was recently a renewed push for a student unit record system, which would essentially provide students and families with better data about, when they're going into a program or they're going into a major, what kind of jobs they can get on the other end of that, and what kind of jobs those programs are sending people into.
So some of the transparency issues that Tori talked about. But just, looking at it from, our perspective here in New Hampshire, we talked about the programs here. The federal government seems confused about this. The programs are confusing. There's so many. There's acronyms everywhere. Is there an argument, Adam, that to be made that the federal government isn't managing this well, that it's too big?
Well, there's certainly the argument to be made there. And there have been calls for years to change how student loans are run. Even recently, there's a discussion of what would happen if we moved the student loan system to the Treasury. And in 1995, you had people wanting to eliminate the Department of Education altogether and kind of create a new form of loans. Or a new system for loans. So you see that conversation happening over and over again, but there hasn't really been much kind of deconstructing of the loan system as of yet.
Well, and it would take a lot to deconstruct it because there's a lot there. Kevin, how do you view the federal government's role in this? Can you just describe that for us, please?
Sure. Well, the federal government's role is obviously we want to have an educated society across the nation. And we have to remember that this is financial aid. It's financial assistance. It's not going to be the financial solution. College, university, education is an investment in someone's future. And a lot of that comes with planning. When we think about an investment in real estate, there's assistance out there provided and there's loans available. But ultimately, it's based on the responsibility of the individual that's purchasing it. A car. I mean, let's face it, the cost of an education is high. It's like buying a high-end car for 4 years in a row.
Right.
And most families aren't doing that. I know I'm not doing that. but the reality is it is financial aid. It's financial assistance. And the government is assisting. They have programs. Yes, there's some complexities to administration of those programs and those acronyms. And it's a very confusing landscape. But that's why there's financial aid professionals across the state and across the U.S. that are working at these higher education institutions to help explain and navigate this process for their students and the families in order to realize their ultimate goal, which is their college education and investment in their future.
So the federal role, you would say, is appropriate?
They provide a lot of resources, yes. They're never going to have the solution. They leave it up to the states because we see state movements to say, hey, we'll make community college free. California's trying to move that way. New Hampshire has talked about community college. But it's one step. But ultimately, the higher educations, the public institutions, are the responsibility of the states. But obviously, we want to have an educated society across the nation. And that's why the federal government's involved.
Do you want to jump in, Tori?
I think it's really important when you think of how much aid and assistance the federal government provides. So Kevin is president of the State Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, so all the folks on college campuses who administer aid. And one of the things that that organization has tracked is how much federal aid as a state do we have in the state of New Hampshire to help kids pay for college. And for the 2014-15 academic year, there was over $750 million that was brought in and administered at the state level at these colleges to help families pay for college, whether that's grants or scholarships. Without that assistance, I'm not sure how we'd get to that educated workforce. So they do bring a really critical role in that they're providing those dollars to help pay for college.
So, and again, there's this broader policy goal that, you know, the federal government doesn't help me buy a new car, but it might help me a little bit with these loans in the interest, the broader societal interest of having an educated citizenry. And by the way, they're loans, so eventually they do get paid back. But after a short break, we'll talk about why default rates are so high for student loans. All that's coming up, plus your phone calls, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Okay, so how do trees fare in times of drought?
Well, it depends on the tree type.
This week on Something Wild, Chris and Dave get some professional help.
Climate change forecasts suggest that in the future, although we'll likely experience more total rainfall, we're also expected to see more frequent and severe droughts.
Don't miss this week's or any week's story. Subscribe to NHPR's Something Wild wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, student loans, the policy and the practical. We're finding out what changes may be in store for college students who need to borrow. And in New Hampshire, that's a lot of them. Let's get your questions and comments in. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Adam Harris is here, breaking news reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Tori Berube, Vice President for College Planning and Community Engagement at the NEEF Network. That's the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation. And Kevin Petrowski, President of the New Hampshire Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. One more time, that number for your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. So all of you, let's go right back to our listeners and go to some emails that have been coming in. And here's one from Joey in Manchester who says, I am the first person in my family who was able to go to college. I grew up with a single mom who was working two jobs to get by with no knowledge of what the needs of higher education were and a father who was not supportive financially. When I was trying to get help to go to school, I was only able to get $2,000 in scholarship and the FAFSA, that's the free, tell us what again it is again, Kevin, the free application
for federal student aid.
Thank you. Lots of alphabet soup in this topic. The FAFSA required me to get my father's financial aid to apply, even though he had nothing to do with me at the time and didn't want me to have that information. Because of this, my mother received a PLUS loan she should not have qualified for and was not able to pay for. I went to a two-year certificate school, and I am still paying off the debt. Wow, Joey, almost 20 years later. So thank you so much for the email, Joey. And this is just a couple questions in my mind. First of all, the very practical, a PLUS loan. What is a PLUS loan, Tori?
So a PLUS loan is actually, it's the federal parent loan for undergraduate students. And that is a loan that comes from the federal government for a parent for the benefit of their undergraduate student. So in theory, after all of the, if you think about the cost of college, cost of attendance, take out any of the other aid that your student has received, whether that be federal or institutional, what's left over, a parent PLUS loan is one of the vehicles that families use to fund what's left over. That loan is a parent obligation and is something that we're starting to hear lots of things out of Washington about the possible discontinuation of that program.
Of the PLUS loans.
Of the PLUS loans for the parent.
And why is that?
I think because for the upcoming academic year, which starts on July 1st, the interest rates on those loans will be 7% fixed. It is a loan that checks the credit worthiness of the parent at the time that they apply, but is also not checking the capacity of the parent to repay that loan. And I think that the federal government, and maybe Adam can speak to this, is starting to realize that there are some significant problems in that program with the capacity of parents to not default on those parent PLUS loans.
Well, and default for student loans, the rate there is going up. So what about that, Adam? What's the sort of Washington chatter that you hear about these parent PLUS loans? And I've got another email, too, on this. So it's clearly a big topic for our listeners.
Yeah, well, we saw kind of a reduction in PLUS loans under the Obama administration, and that's not discontinued. That's kept going as you know, as we've moved into the Trump administration. Now, a lot of schools thought that this may have been saw this as a bad thing. They see the reduction in PLUS loans as a bad thing. We think of historically black colleges for one as a way that this is. They see it as it's precluding a lot of students from being able to attend universities. But you also see the proposed elimination of a lot of different kinds of loans. So you see subsidized Stafford loans, which were proposed to be eliminated in the Trump's budget proposal. So this is just kind of one of an ongoing conversation about, the types of loans that should be kept and the types that should be eliminated.
Well, and thank you for the email, Joey, and good luck to you. And here's another email from Shirley in Nashua, who also talks about Parent PLUS loans. She says, are there any options now or being planned for helping repay Parent PLUS loans? The interest keeps accumulating and is fairly high, 7%, over 7%, Shirley says. And even when I have had the option not to pay for a while, due to being on disability, the interest keeps adding up. Now Shirley says, I'm about to lose my job, and again, the interest will add up, even if I get a reprieve from paying for a while. Wow, Shirley, tough situation. And Tori, people forget that there's the amount of the loan and then there's the interest, and it sounds like Shirley gets a break when she's in tough times on the amount, but not the interest.
Correct. So for Parent PLUS loans, one of the things that I would encourage Shirley to ask her loan servicer about if there are some medical issues is that might she qualify to have that loan actually forgiven under something called total and permanent disability if she's got those medical issues. Repayment plans for Parent PLUS loans are limited at best after she's exhausted, which it sounds like she has, something called deferment and forbearance time, which are short periods of time where she can stop making payments based on certain criteria. But during those periods of time, interest is accruing on those loans. And those are interest rates that could be, depending on when she took out her loan, 6.5%, 7%, 7.25%. So interest is accruing on those loans. So I would certainly encourage her to talk with her servicer about possible repayment plans or to look into total and permanent disability.
If she can get the servicer on the phone.
If she can.
Because as we talked earlier, there have been a lot of complaints about these servicing companies. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is obviously communication with the servicer. For any loan. It is about communication. You need to communicate, and hopefully it's not that tough of a thing to get them on the phone because that's their job to, in order to be there for the student and the parent borrower. But the reality is, too, with the Parent PLUS loan, even though it does have a fixed interest rate and it does have loan fees, which a lot of private loans do not have in this current state, you do pay for some accommodations with repayment options. There are more repayment options still with a PLUS loan than a private loan.
So these are these private loans or sort of federally arranged?
Well, I'm talking about the private loans from the private financial sectors. Yeah. But this Parent PLUS loan, they do have repayment options. Obviously, the standard, which is the 10 years repayment with a fixed amount. There is the graduated and the extended payment plans along with the Parent PLUS loan. And one that a lot of people don't know is there's income contingent repayment plan for Parent PLUS loans, but you need to consolidate it first into the direct loan consolidation in order to use that plan. But there are options, and there are more options for a Parent PLUS loan versus a lot of their private loans.
And this is an important point, Kevin, that everything I've read, everything says exhaust your federal loan options before you go private, because as you just pointed out, there are a lot more protections if you get one of these federal loans than going to purely private loans.
There are protections, but obviously you're paying for those protections through the fees or maybe a higher interest rate if you do have a great credit score, great credit history versus, but they are also to provide access because parents with mid-range to low credit history scores, these PLUS loans are more accessible than if they're going to go to the private sector.
Okay. Well, Shirley, good luck. And I'm sorry that you're struggling. And let's go back to our listeners. Nick joins us from Concord. Hi, Nick. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. How you doing?
Fine. Go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to offer an additional loan option here. Under RSA 110, the State of New Hampshire code, all National Guardsmen are allowed to have free college at all the state colleges and community colleges as far as the tuition goes. So that's another benefit. Also, the Guard offers $50,000 student loan repayment for those people who have graduated high school, college, as you were.
So there are some benefits to doing some military service, you're saying, Nick?
And
people need to know about that.
Correct. Yes, that's not federal service either. This is state service here in the state of New Hampshire. So you're working in the state of New Hampshire for the state of New Hampshire.
Okay. Thank you very much for calling in, Nick. I appreciate it. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk a little bit more, all of you, about defaults. And to you, Adam, I think in March, the Consumer Federation of America released a report saying millions of Americans were defaulting on their student loans. This is measured by those who don't make a payment for 9 months. Now, people could be defaulting, you know, every other month, and that wasn't even included. What's behind these defaults, Adam? What are people saying?
Well, there are a couple things. One is that, you know, a lot of students aren't even, you know, getting into contact with their servicer, or the servicers aren't reaching out to the students to get into contact with them. And that was one of the things that the Obama administration tried to improve, was that customer service between the servicer and the borrower. So that's something that could, you know, improve or, you know, help decrease the default rate. The other thing is, you know, some people point to the you know, the inability of the federal government to kind of directly deduct, you know, some of the money used for student loan payments from people's accounts. That's one of the reasons why they were trying to, or they discussed moving student loan servicing to the Treasury, because they would already have that income information. They could automatically enroll people in income-driven payment programs, different things like that. So there are a couple of factors that are driving defaults, and there's, you know, ongoing conversation going on the Hill about how to fix the issue.
And conversations, Adam, about possibly changing the way the loan servicing is done, as you said, consolidating down to one loan servicer. Is that supposed to help?
Yes.
I know that's a debate, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. They're essentially saying that if you consolidate down to one loan servicer, it'll improve communication. Now, the subsequent argument is that if that one loan servicer isn't able to, you know, reach all of the borrowers that it needs to, it has to subcontract out to scale so that it can, you know, reach all of those borrowers and help all of those borrowers. But the federal government would have less oversight over those subcontractors in that situation. So a lot of advocates worry that if we move to this situation where we have a single loan servicer, then a lot of the people who are you know, being helped out by, you know, these smaller agencies, there may be an issue there with the customer service.
Okay. So that's a debate that we can expect from Washington. And Adam, we really appreciate you giving us your expertise today. We'll talk again. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Adam Harris, breaking news reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Go ahead, Tori, you want to jump in?
One of the things, and I've been working in this space for about 15 years, and one of the things that has dramatically changed in how we talk with borrowers who are in repayment is when I first started, if you think about it, most of the communication was paper, right? So it was mailing them a statement, mailing them a delinquency letter, a series of phone calls that servicers are required to make before those 9 months are up. In our work at the Center for College Planning, we see students and families come in literally with paper bags with unopened envelopes because they're too afraid to open the envelope and read what that servicer is. It's just the angst and the anxiety of, oh my goodness, I don't even want to look at this. But one of the interesting things that many servicers are starting to use now, based on the population and the way that we communicate today, emails, texting. And a lot of borrowers, young borrowers, find even a text from their servicer is a unique way to reach back to them to ask a question, because it's less intrusive. It's not as scary as opening an envelope. So kind of a very different shift that we've seen from when I started to what work we see today.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in real quickly now with our June fund drive. So is that quickness, that immediacy, what do you think, Tori? Is that a good change in terms of connecting students and their loan services a little bit more? Or is it just different?
It's different and it's new. So I can't speak to, is it working per se? But we've actually had students come in and say, or young people in repayment come in and say, I got this text and this is what it says. And it seems less threatening to them than picking up the phone, listening to a voicemail, opening a scary envelope. So yeah. If it leads to somebody communicating and asking about the status of their loan or how they can repay that loan or are there options, I'm all for it.
What do you think, Kevin?
I agree that those options of communication are available, and I think they are directly addressing the populations of today, but those are also all opt-in ones to email certain emails because of privacy laws. Schools can't just send out a text message to individuals, nor can servicers. They need to opt in for that. So obviously it's the initial state of the borrower to establish those standards. But yes, the mode of communication is available out there and it's better to get the word out. But the reality is the borrower has to opt into these.
Well, and maybe if it's a text, it's a little easier to understand than the letters that they send you. I mean, my goodness, the language involved. I mean, you guys could figure it out, but for your average person, the language is quite convoluted, and maybe in a text they have to keep it simple. Let's go back to our listeners, and Alice is on the line from Center Harbor. Hi, Alice. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question and a comment. My question is, once a loan is approved for a student, does that check go directly to the student or to the school. If it goes to the student, I think they could use it for anything they wanted to, and that's a concern. The other concern is that I see so many young parents. And I just wonder if they're, you know, spending money on boats and vacations and so on. Are they saving for college? Is there any kind of a program that's doing some public relations on you know, encouraging them to save? And then they very often I think they don't, and then they just depend upon the federal government.
Yeah, well, two good questions, and thank you, Alice. And to that second question. First, Kevin, the idea that people aren't saving for college and then, you know, when it comes time to pay, they just turn to the federal government. But you still have to give a statement of your income. So if you make a ton of money, correct me if I'm wrong, you make a ton of money, you spend a ton of money, the federal government's not going to say, oh, that's okay that you bought a boat, Laura. We're going to give you some really, you know, nice student loans. I mean, they look at your capacity.
Yes, that's correct. And the reality is, like I stated earlier, college is an investment. So one of the key components is savings. And the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, does look at a financial picture, but it's not looking at choice of financial actions. So whether I decide to own a $100,000 house versus a $400,000 house, that's on me. The FAFSA is not taking that into account. It's looking at what is your income, what are your assets, and what's your ability to pay. It's not looking at credit card debt. It's not looking at mortgages or, you know, your vacation houses, et cetera. It's not looking at that. It doesn't take that into account. So that it does look at the financial picture and the ability to pay. In relation to savings, one of the things that has prospered through the past 10 years or so is the 529 savings plan. Those are state run. There is one issued by every state, whether the state agency or a private financial institution runs it. In the state of New Hampshire, Fidelity runs the 529 savings plan. And that is really an educational savings plan that's operated by the state to help families set aside funds for future costs. And the reality is those distributions that come out of that, they're tax-free from the federal income tax. Check with your state for state tax. But the reality is the earnings, too, that are deposited are tax-deferred. So that's a great way for students and families to save. The reality is anyone can open a 529 savings plan. So a grandparent, a cousin, an aunt, an uncle, whoever, does not have to be the biological or adoptive parent in relation to when you talk about some of the federal student aid, according to the FAFSA, is connected to that.
Well, and to her first question, and Alice, thank you so much. Who does the money go to, Tori? Does it go to the student or does it go to the college?
It goes directly to the college and posted to the student's account.
Okay, so it's not like they can spend it on, you know, pizza and beer. Okay.
Correct.
All right. Alice, thank you so much for being with us. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. More on student loans on the exchange coming up. Stay with us.
Listening to NHPR's The Exchange when something interrupts.
What do other states allow? Do they say that is okay?
Oh, that's interesting.
Hey, Linda, the TPS reports are due in 15 minutes. And we need to go over the quarterly numbers.
Oh, okay.
Because,
check out The Exchange podcast feed and never miss another fascinating discussion again. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the status of student loans with changes coming to these programs. Join us with your questions and your suggestions. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Tori Berube, Kevin Petrowski, let's go right back to our listeners. And David's in Stratum. Hi, David. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead, David.
So I started out with just a kind of anecdote about, I know two pretty impressive young people that grew up in New Hampshire and were accepted to UNH, an out-of-state Ivy League school. And the financial packages they received from those Ivy League schools resulted in far lower out-of-state expenses, and those two students are going to an out-of-state Ivy League school instead of UNH.
Wow.
So, to be a pretty sad commentary on the state of our public education system in New Hampshire, that we lose, like, the best and the brightest out of state. But I also have one other comment.
Okay.
And it's a member of your panel kept saying that higher education is an investment. While that is true now, I don't think that it should be. As a state and a nation, we should be trying to modernize and catch up with other nations that afford free or very inexpensive higher education to their students. The goal of the public higher education system should be to allow for all constituents to get as educated as they are capable of doing on a merit basis. You know, so wherever the next NASA scientist or computer programmer or auto mechanic or cardiologist is born, whatever their demographic situation is, how much money they have, what their family situation is, we should want to afford them the opportunity to get that training and get as far as they can go. The investment that the individual should make in their education should be time and effort, not financial.
Okay.
You know, many European
hard work at the college right. level should pay off, and you shouldn't have to worry about it. So a shout out from David for more public investment in higher education at the federal and the state level. And I've got an email here from Michael, David, that kind of lines up with what you're saying. So thank you for the call. Michael says, I'm a full-time college professor in New Hampshire, and my son is a senior in high school. He's considering a college in Massachusetts because of many reasons, including costs, student loans, and scholarships. Michael says, all of my alma maters are New Hampshire-based colleges, and it concerns me that costs and student loans are forcing this decision. Michael, thank you so much for the email. And Tori, boy, we started out talking about this and we've come full circle.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Right. It is, we work with, at the Center for College Planning, we work with about 22,000 people each year looking, making their college decision. And I'm not surprised by the comments that you're receiving this morning.
Let's take another call. This is Alex in Rochester. Hi, Alex. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, I had a student loan debt that originally the total principal was approximately $20,000 after attending the University of New Hampshire in Durham. That was back in 1998. I then had a disability, and I wasn't able to repay even the interest on the loan, and so the interest got compounded. And as of 2 years ago, the total amount was like over $60,000, and that's just from interest alone being compounded into the principal.
Mm.
And so I wound up getting what's called a disability discharge because I have an official disability. And some listeners may not be aware of that if they have a disability. There are conditions that go along with that. That's what worked for me. The other thing that I don't hear talked about is in very rare cases, it is possible to get student loan debt discharged through regular bankruptcy. Very rare cases, though.
Well, Alex, I'm glad you called because we should talk about getting student loans discharged. This is an issue, and we also heard from Shirley earlier in an email, also struggling with student loans and a disability. To you first, I think, Kevin, in what types of cases are student loans dissolved, discharged, written off, however you want to put it?
Okay. So, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, the first point is to communicate with your servicer. Always to know your options. But there are disability discharges. Again, all of these options weigh heavily on paperwork and documentation proof. Their repayment plans have discharges after so many on-time payments, 10 years, 15 years, 12 years, then the rest is either forgiven or canceled or discharged. There's also another option out there is a public service loan forgiveness program that pretty much takes your student loan debt, your federal, and if you volunteer and be employed through a public service organization for at least 10 years and make your 120 on-time payments, then the rest is canceled as well. There's about 552,000 borrowers that are participating currently in the public service loan forgiveness program doing their tenure of employment, contributing their work efforts to the organizations that obviously this was a high need area that the Department of Education defined and the federal government that says we need to drive workforce that way and to pretty much serve these private sectors that were not getting qualified individuals. So they have been committed to this work effort, but this is one of the programs that's on the FY18 chopping block to pretty much get rid of, void out, and cancel.
The FY18 chopping block is a budget proposal. It's, yes. This is not
yes,
something
it's,
that's,
it's,
you
it's
know,
a, it's a proposal,
signed
correct.
And sealed and delivered
absolutely
and so
not.
Forth.
Yes, a lot yeah. of the allegations.
And that, from so. What I understand, people who are currently working in those sort of high-need public service areas, expecting that they would have their loans forgiven, those folks are grandfathered in. It's new people that would be hurt
correct.
By this proposal, capital P proposal. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is correct. It is just the reality that it would obviously negate the driving force for the workforces to expand into these private sectors and these areas that need highly qualified individuals. And it was one of the forgiveness and one of the major forgiveness cancellation programs.
So who pays, Tori, when, you know, people default or their loans are forgiven or wiped out or whatever?
That would be taxpayers, right? So those are federal dollars that are appropriated and given to students in need that are not paid back. So that's U.S. taxpayers picking up that bill in the hopes of bettering our community, bettering our state, bettering our nation. But again, those are debts that are forgiven at the federal level.
Sure. So I'm guessing that, and it's too bad Adam couldn't stay with us, that that's a policy debate, right? I mean,
sure.
Some people listening may think, you know, I paid off my loans. Why should taxpayers pick up your loans that you weren't able to pay off?
Correct. Exactly correct. So Kevin mentioned public service loan forgiveness. In the last couple of weeks, there has been some buzz around the current program that President Obama implemented. There is also a loan forgiveness program for teachers in certain high-need areas, whether it be geographic or certain subjects. That one hasn't appeared on anything that I've read about a possible chopping block. But to Kevin's point, the public service loan forgiveness, which is very popular for people working at 501c3s, municipalities, that seems to be one that's in discussion for the next budget cycle.
So some folks who are going into high-need areas might not if they thought that they would have to
right.
pay off that whole college loan.
And when we work with families and talk to them and they say, I'll just go apply for federal loan forgiveness, we always preface it by saying, just know that the landscape often changes and what you think may be here today or you're hoping on for 4 years from now or 8 years from now when that loan is in repayment may not be.
Go ahead, Kevin. I can see you want to jump in.
I just have a couple things. Since we're back on default rate, just want to note that New Hampshire, even though we have one of the highest loan borrowing amounts in the U.S., we have one of the lowest default rates in the U.S. as well. We're in the bottom five.
So our students emerge from this and they figure
and
it out.
They are figuring out the ability to repay and perhaps using the repayment plans that are provided to them as well. And also, in relation to cohort default rates, obviously the taxpayers do pay. I agree with Tori. The taxpayers do pay. But school institutions and students share that responsibility as well. Cohort default rates do impact institutions and
what
their
does
ability.
That mean, cohort default rate?
Cohort default rates, so the government measures a default group, so a cohort group, I should say, excuse me, that they look at the past 2 years and they went into repayment within the last 3 years. So looking at 2 years and 3 years, and right now it's currently just 3 years. And they just look at this group and, okay, let's say there's 100 borrowers that went into repayment and there's 10 borrowers that defaulted. So then obviously the default rate is 10%, that cohort default rate is 10%. So these are published rates annually by the Department of Education, and they do impact institutions' abilities to administer and provide financial aid.
You know, we talked earlier about the 529s, which is not a state grant, but it is a state program that helps people save, Tori. And Kevin was saying earlier how great it was. How much do grant staters know about this?
We work with families in the state of New Hampshire every day that have not tapped into a 529 plan. We know nationally about a third of U.S. residents know what a 529 college savings plan is. Only 14% of them actually have one. They're great. It's after-tax dollars that you can use for a child. They're transferable from child to child if they need to be. Small investment. It can be as low as $25 a month invested in a mutual fund. And as long as it's used for qualified education expenses, great way to save for college.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in real quickly now with our June fund drive. So as we close out, Kevin, what else is there that you really just want people to know that there are programs, assistance, and so forth available? And most people, you know, walk into your office and go, gee, I never knew that existed.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things, again, we talked about planning and the research, but there are other ways, and I wanted to really cap on those. How do you really reduce student loan debt overall? Is one of the things is every student or family should sign up for a payment plan, regardless of what the amount. It's just like the savings that Tori mentioned with the 529, $25 a month, $50 a month. If you can get it to $100 a month, that's pretty much $1,000 a year because most payment plans are 10 months. At an institution, and that becomes, you know, for a four-year degree, that's $4,000. So $4,000, that's a saving of almost $900 in interest based on the current interest rate. So
payment plan means pay a little bit while you're still in school?
Yes, you can set them up with the institution that you attend. They use third-party services. It's very, very simple to do, but any amount that you can pay, a fantastic investment in the overall reduction of debt. Now, another way when students go to college, obtain a job. You can obtain jobs through Federal Work Study, which offers part-time employment, as well as most universities have university-paid positions where the departments support them and fund them. And it's a great way to accumulate funds for costs for books down the road. So there's a reduction in the cost for books. And then again, all about the research, figuring out, do I want to go to school A because it has this reputation and I can get my communications degree there, or school B, comparable communications plan, but if we don't even know what this school name is, you know, is it more about the value of the sweatshirt and the logo versus, you know, the overall? So those type of decisions need to be made. And really, another thing that's very interesting in colleges, they have flat rates for tuition for full time. And that ranges from 12 to 16 credits. At most institutions, maybe 12 to 15. The reality is stack up on your credits. If you're taking 12 credits a semester, it's going to take you more than 4 years to complete that degree because bachelor degrees are 120 credits. And
so if you have a flat rate for tuition, take a lot of classes.
Take advantage of it because at 120 credits, you have to average 15 credits a semester to have 30 a year in order to graduate on time in 4 years. So definitely take advantage. And then look at also the overcharge when you go above and beyond the flat rate because you may be able to save money if you can afford to take those credits and your academics allows you to. It'd be a great way to advance your degree and minimize your cost.
Well, and if you want the prestigious sweatshirt, just go to the gift shop and get one. But you don't necessarily have to attend the school to wear the sweatshirt. I want to let everybody know that we put a ton of information from your organizations on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And this has been great. Thank you both so much for being here. Tori, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tori Berube, Vice President for College Planning and Community Engagement at the NEEF Network. That's the New Hampshire Higher Education Assistance Foundation. Kevin, really good to meet you too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That's Kevin Petrowski, President of the New Hampshire Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators, also Vice President of Financial Aid at Southern New Hampshire University. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our interns are Edie Allard and Alana Pearson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.